let's call to order the House Committee on Land Use for Tuesday, March 31, 2009. Open a work session on House Bill 2227. Colleagues, we have seen quite a bit of this bill. We have heard testimony in Redmond. We've heard public testimony twice in Salem. We've had a couple of work sessions on this bill. There has been a fair amount of discussion and suggestions and notions on how this bill can be improved. And it is now time for us to make some decisions. So I think that's what our responsibility is this afternoon. Representative Garrett.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 9 amendments to House Bill 2227.
Representative Garrett moves the dash 9 amendments to House Bill 2227. Just so that the committee and the audience knows, I will entertain any additional amendments if someone wants to propose them, either in addition to or as a substitute for this, if someone wants to make that motion. Let me briefly explain. Members of the committee have had a hand-marked up copy of the Dash 9, and we've distributed to everyone a hand-engrossed copy of the bill incorporating the Dash 9 into it. Since we last met, everyone, the changes from the Dash 7 are to clarify that an evaluation and updating by the department is strictly permissive. It is not required. We are giving them the authority to do it, not a mandate to do it. Secondly, we have corrected the citation to irrigation districts, so we get the right ORS citation in there in the section defining where resorts may not be cited. We have stricken the reference to irrigation districts under the definition of high-value cropland. The reason for that deletion is that while the amendment intends to exclude destination resorts from being situated in irrigation districts, it was not the intent, and the amendment does not require a 3-mile buffer around irrigation districts. We have added two pieces of issues for the department to study and possibly update relating to the issue of suitability of irrigation districts within destination resorts, and also the economic benefits of destination resorts to local and state economies. We have clarified language in existing law that determines where destination resorts may be cited, but does not require that they do be cited when a map has been determined. And finally, changing from the Dash 7, we have clarified that workforce housing does not have to be provided on-site, could be provided off-site. And I will address the intention there in my final comments. So, with the amendment before us, is there discussion from committee members on the motion to accept, to move the Dash 9 amendment into the bill?
I didn't hear that.
Is there discussion on the motion to amend? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, I would like to make a motion that we substitute the Dash 10s for the Dash 9.
Representative Esquivel, I don't have a Dash 10.
Huh? They were given. I believe you have them in your packet.
Right.
And what those are, Madam Chair, is they are actually the dash eights, but there was one word correction in that bill that we had made to make them the dash tens.
Representative Esquivel has moved to substitute the dash 10 amendment. And since we haven't entertained the dash 8, can you explain what this amendment does?
Sure, I'd be glad to.
We had the dash 7s in front of us, and the dash 7s needed, in our opinion, first of all, we needed a work group. We asked for that work group and finally received it this last Thursday, and I was asked to get some people involved in this that had a stake in it, which were not involved with the previous work group. The people involved were people that represented some destination resorts, represented some a couple of entities, and there were two different groups involved. The Association of Realtors was involved in this, and we came up with the following. We had also Mr. Livingston, which represents some entities down in my neck of the woods. What we did is on these dash 10, which is now the dash 10, which were the 8s, we changed page 2 after line 13 and page 4, lines 1 and 2. We deleted page 4, lines 1 and 2, and inserted a new subsection 2H after page 2, line 13 as follows. 8, the suitability of excluding destination resorts from irrigation district organized under ORS Chapter 545, which the dash 9s actually, again, allow it for the study part, but then it leaves it back in the bill, so it's there in the first place, and our intention was to take it out of the bill, put it under the study part. Page 2 after line 13, insert as a new item, I, the economic benefits of resorts to the local and state economies. We felt it was very, and which was complied with the dash, let's see, 9s. I'm trying to remember how these go. The dash 9s, that should be part of the study, which I believe the dash 9s also include. The other things that we have are on page 4, lines 17 and 18, we deleted the following language. Or an area within the boundaries of an irrigation district organized under ORS Chapter 545, this language duplicates page 4, lines 1 and 2, but because it is now in the definition of a high-value crop area, it must be read in combination with page 3, line 30, which establishes a 3-mile buffer zone around high-value crop areas. And some of these, of course, we've taken care of in both these amendments. This is the effect of establishing the same 3-mile buffer around irrigation districts. The extraordinary expansion of the area off limits with to destination resorts development was not mentioned by Mr. Whitman on the hearing of March 26, 2009. It is unclear if it was deliberate. Page 5, line 2, delete, mitigate, and replace with minimize. This has already been discussed in the hearings, as we've discussed prior to this, that in land use, mitigate is something completely different than minimize. Now, people may tell you different, but I have been around vernal pools, I've been around one-trip thresholds, and there is a difference. If you want to really get technical, I guess one could go back through and see all the different land use hearings and actions within the state of Oregon. On page 5, lines 14 and 15, we deleted the words provided for and replaced with demonstrate that at the end. Add the words is available. Thus, 4C would read, demonstrate that workforce housing for individuals working in the resort is available. We felt this was very important because why would you necessarily have to have on-site housing for the employees? Maybe the employees live within a community within 25 miles, 20 miles of it, and maybe they want to stay in their house. So that's basically what it is. So if you have any questions, feel free to ask.
Discussion on the motion to substitute.
Madam Chair,
Just one moment, or one question.
Okay, Representative Klein.
I'm just trying to quickly juggle. What was the language on workforce housing that your 4C either replaces or for comparison purposes?
The dash 9 says provide for workforce housing on site or off site for individuals working at the resort.
Madam Chair.
Or off site versus available.
Representative Klein, hold the floor just a minute.
So,
Representative Klein?
Yeah, just, I mean, in comparing those two, that one, it looks like there would have a similar outcome, basically. Demonstrate versus provide for is the key. They could both be off-site, but in one case, you're just saying there are houses in the world 20 miles away, they may live there, and they're there. So that's a demonstration. And here, you actually would have to provide for housing on or off-site for the people working there.
Yes. And provide for does not mean provide, but provide that it is available.
Oh, that's key right there.
Yeah. Did you have further questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I disagree with that. Provide for means provide for. Let's not mince words here. Provide for means that you must provide for anyone that works for you housing, period.
Is there further discussion on the motion to substitute? Call the roll, please.
Representative Klim.
No.
Representative Cowan.
No.
Representative Greenlee.
No.
Representative Hannah.
Yes.
Representative Wiener.
Yes.
Vice Chair Garrett.
No.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes.
Chair Nolan.
No. Motion fails. Further discussion on the motion to move the dash 9. Representative Klim.
I'm going to support the dash 9s. I would like to have, not right now, but some clarifying statement from legislative council or something on that term, provide for, to make it clear that legislative intent is that you don't have to build them housing off-site. It's just provide for, just so we've got it for the record. I feel fairly strongly about the irrigation district language. I think it would be appropriate to have it studied, but I would like the protection for the water right holders in the irrigation districts while it's being studied, and if it somehow ends up being too expansive, then I would like to receive the study that says somehow we shouldn't have protection for the existing water right holders in an irrigation district, which are most of the times agricultural users. And not always. There are people who water their lawns in irrigation districts too. They're usually the more junior water right holders, but I have an interest in general in trying to protect irrigation districts for agricultural irrigation. And I think other than that, well, the void or minimize, they are different. There's no doubt they're different. I'm not even sure that one is weaker or stronger than the other. It's just different. I almost like avoid, comma, minimize, or mitigate, but I can support what we've got here in dash 9s.
Okay. Representative Garrett.
On that point, I also agree with Representative Klem that our choice of the word mitigate is a change from the word minimize. They're not the same thing. And we heard testimony that the word minimize has been interpreted to require very little in the way of reduction. And this represents a different way of thinking about it, which in a lot of cases will actually provide developers with more flexibility than the word minimize would. So I think it's a good change, and I support it.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. with regard to the discussion around workforce housing, I just sort of want to chime in that I, too, would like to understand the interpretation of those words. I lean a little towards the closer to the verbiage in the dash 10, depending on that interpretation. So the reason I ask that that be explored a little bit is that that's a piece that maybe could be considered on the Senate side.
Thank you. Or we could get clarifying language on that for floor debate.
That's true, too.
Or it could be adjusted there. Any other discussion on the motion to move the dash 9 amendment? I just wanted to put a couple of things on the record here, since we've talked at some length about this bill. It is my understanding, and I think the intent of the language, that passage of the of House Bill 2227 with the dash 9 amendment will not affect existing maps already adopted by counties that identify the opportunity for destination resorts. I think we've had a lot of testimony about that. I wanted to be really clear that this bill with this amendment will not affect existing maps already adopted. It will not affect already approved destination resorts. It will not affect application that was filed before the effective date of the bill. The effect, the bill does not have an emergency clause on it, so it has a default effective date, which is January 1, 2010.
Madam Chair?
Just a minute, I'm not quite finished, oh. Representative. I also wanted to clarify, since we've had some discussion in both hearing and work session and even today, Section 6 contains standards for the siting of new destination resorts. Specifically, subsection 4 adds three new siting criteria for resorts. And the first criterion is avoid or mitigate direct and indirect adverse effects on state highways, county roads, and city streets, which would be incumbent on counties when siting a new resort to consider the adverse transportation effects on the proposed resort of the proposed resort and then avoid or mitigate them. The intent of this language is that there will be adverse effect determined to exist only if the new resort development increases traffic to the extent that the existing capacity of the road becomes overutilized. Roads already have some capacity, and roads throughout the state are not operate. Most roads throughout the state are not currently operating at capacity. So adding, we've talked in this committee about adding one car would have an adverse impact. That's not the case here. The language itself doesn't say that, but I wanted to make it clear that if the capacity is already there, then the adverse impact would accrue only if either the capacity of the roads in question is overutilized or a particular intersection begins to fail. The direction to mitigate is intended to mean that the adverse effect will be reduced roughly in proportion to the degree to which that adverse impact can be traced to the resort. There's not an intention here that the resort has to take responsibility for all adverse impacts, only the adverse impacts that can be directly traced to the resort. And I just wanted to make sure that was on the record. Further discussion, Representative Wingert?
Well, what was the previous? I had a question, I just a clarifying question about the previous point you were making.
I was clarifying the effective date of the bill.
Oh, yes, thanks. I just wanted to make sure that what I heard you say was that any county that has done the mapping process and has created areas where destination resorts can apply, that you're saying that those maps are grandfathered in and that anybody can come in with a destination resort proposal and they'll be able to site in those maps that the county has worked. Is that what I heard you say?
If the map has been approved, this bill does not change that approval.
Madam Chair, just thank you. And the other part was about applications, and that was sort of with the Gilchrist, that if you have a completed, you've submitted a complete application, then this bill doesn't affect you, which is a different issue than the map. Like the folks from Gilchrist who are here, their application is in, it's already been approved. So that would be an example of someone unaffected by this bill. And the map is a different matter than an application.
I just want to be clear that I'm thank you, Madam Chair, that for those counties that have done extensive mapping and they have essentially mapped areas where they will permit destination resorts to apply, the rules that we're passing here are prospective for future maps, and that the maps that currently exist, is what I'm hearing, that the maps that currently exist are grandfathered in, and that a person can come in with a destination resort idea a year, 2, 5, 10 years from now and use a map that's already been created and cite according to those rules.
Representative, the distinction I want to make is that the existence of a map is not sufficient. The perfection of the map is what's important. If it has been approved, this bill does not change it. But if it is still in the process of approval and has not yet been approved on the effective date of this bill, then it is subject to this law.
Okay. So you're saying approved by LCDC?
All the way through the process. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along that line, because I wrote a message to does not affect existing maps with a question mark, I thought we took testimony from Mr. Whitman when he described the irrigation map overlay that showed areas previously mapped as those lands for destination resorts that would be precluded because they then resided within the irrigation district.
The bill has a clause about approving a map or approving siting of a resort. And both the approval of the map and the siting of the resort have to meet the terms of the bill.
Follow up? Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think I understand that piece. But for clarity's sake, I believe that we heard testimony and we were shown maps of irrigation districts that overlapped mapping previously completed of destination resort lands that would be precluded because of the irrigation district overlay.
Mr. Whitman, can you help us clarify this?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. The question before you is on House Bill 2227-9, whether, as drafted, the bill would...
amended.
Excuse me?
As amended, not as drafted.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlick, that's correct. Whether the bill, as amended by the Dash 9 amendments...
The amendment itself, yes.
Would, and I need to be careful here because this is a subtle distinction, would affect the destination resort mapping of the counties. So let me try to explain that subtle distinction. The bill would not require the counties to amend destination resort mapping that they have adopted. It would, however, for a new destination resort application that comes in after the effective date of this bill, if it is enacted into law, it would require that that new application comply with the siting requirements of the bill as well as the county's destination resort mapping.
Right.
I hope that's clear.
Thanks. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under the scenario described by Mr. Whitman, if a county currently has mapped destination resort properties, and this bill, as amended in the dash nines, which are being proposed, passes, and the lands mapped by the county have a project whose application has been put forth, moves forward under the current rule. If properties within that county map that have been mapped don't have an application applied for, this bill would require that property to go through the additional process under this bill.
That's right. Any application received after the effective date of this bill has to meet the terms of this bill. Yes.
Follow up.
Representative?
Thank you. So if I understand that right, we might be saying the same thing in two different ways, but from my perspective, you know, saying does not affect the mapping is not really correct. In my, from my perspective, and I would think from a public perspective, if you owned land today that had been mapped by the county as potential for destination resort property, though no application had been filed, and you heard someone sitting at this dais say, hey, this bill doesn't affect the mapping, and you got down the road to develop your property as one of these, but then was impacted by this bill, you might be disappointed. So I think it does affect the mapping, but we're talking degrees of separation in terms of the effect.
If a county has an urban growth boundary that is closing in on 100,000 population and has mapped based on the current population, and 5 years from now the population then exceeds it, then you still have to meet the population, the 24-mile limitation here, even if the map, because it's based on old population, doesn't exclude that. So yes, for applications that start after the effective date of the bill. But if the application's already in process, then it is under the current rules. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Two things. One is that 24-mile thing is very interesting because I just received this in a different committee, and you see you virtually wipe out Jackson and Deschutes County, period. Just for the record. The other thing you do is you do Portland, Salem, Eugene. But most of those counties are on the I-5 corridor, those municipalities, and there aren't very many, much need for a destination resort in those particular areas, but there are in rural Oregon. And this is quite a message we're sending to rural Oregon. The other thing I'd like to discuss is this, coming back to this avoid and mitigate direct or indirect adverse effects on state highways, county roads, and city streets. Beyond the stretch of anyone's imagination, that is a one-trip threshold, period. And I'm going to use an example on mitigate versus minimize. We have vernal pools in southern Oregon. A vernal pool is something that's very unique. It has indigenous plants in it, and it has fairy shrimp. In order to change the face of any one of those vernal pools, we have to mitigate it. How could you possibly minimize it? You can't. You mitigate. So that's the distinct difference here. We've created a threshold here, and it does not say that the city has to be within so many miles of this. It just says city streets. It says county roads or state highways. You do an on-site traffic evaluation when you do one of these resorts anyway. Chances are a lot of people will have to put in these destination resorts a turn lane or widening of the highway or something of that nature. Example, Sun River. You've seen what they've done out there. So I think that, just for the record, I want to get it on the record that avoid and mitigate direct and indirect adverse effects on state highways, county roads, and city streets does in fact create a one-trip threshold.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Klein.
I just wanted to clarify for my friend that the 24-mile, that was in the original bill in 87 that created it. We're not doing anything. That's the current law.
It's also in the dash 10.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep. Yeah.
But that's.
Thanks. Call the roll. The motion is to accept the dash 9 amendment.
Representative Klein.
Aye.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Representative Greenland.
Aye.
Representative
Hannah.
No.
Representative Beard.
Aye.
Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
No.
Chair Nolan.
Yes. Motion carries. Representative Garrett.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2227. As amended, all the way through the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Garrett moves House Bill 2227 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Representative Wingert.
I'm wondering if we can get some understanding of how this affects economic activity that's already underway in the state, including destination resorts. I mean, everywhere, but the ones that pop to mind because they've been in the news a lot are the two resorts in the Metolius area. Do we have some idea of how this bill is actually going to affect the various projects that are in various stages of development?
Representative, I think that's the question, the discussion that Representative Hannah and I had. Resorts whose applications are in. Mr. Whitman, why don't you help explain the distinction one more time?
Chair Nolan, members of the committee, again for the record, Richard Whitman, the director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Representative Wingert, again, under the applicability section of the bill, Section 10, as amended, this legislation would not apply to any application for a destination resort that is filed before January 1 of 2010. Representative Wingert, you asked specifically, I believe, about the two potential resorts in Jefferson County. Those no applications have been filed as of yet for those resorts. The county's mapping of areas eligible for destination resorts is currently on appeal with the Oregon Supreme Court, and so at this point no applications have been filed for those resorts.
Thank you.
Further discussion?
I just I think the only possible outcome from this bill is less economic activity, not more. And I have become dismayed by the trend within this committee. We have a business development committee here in the House, and apparently we also have a business undevelopment committee in the House. And we are facing some very, very severe economic circumstances in this state, and there are no areas feeling it worse than the rural areas, where they have unemployment rates already in the double digits, anywhere from 12 to upwards of 20% unemployment. And I just can't imagine why we would move a bill to make economic activity in the rural areas of Oregon even less likely to occur or more expensive. I'm concerned about some of the definitions in the bill, including high-value crop area, and how that doesn't potentially make it impossible to site a resort. But I guess my main issue is that many years ago, when we were in the process of shutting down hundreds of mills throughout Oregon, the message that was delivered to the people of rural Oregon was, don't worry, you'll have tourism. And if you haven't figured out now, or by this point, that there isn't going to be much interest in helping you get tourism, you're not paying attention. And I don't think that we're sending honest messages. I don't think we've been sending honest messages. And I feel very badly for the people of rural Oregon, whose economic situation I don't believe is going to improve anytime soon and is certainly not going to be helped by this bill.
Thank you. Call the roll, please.
Wait a minute.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have spent the time on this bill, and I appreciate that you have been willing to do that. The Lane County portion of my district is currently experiencing an excess of 12% unemployment rate, and the Douglas County portion of my district is currently exceeding 18%. Those are terrible numbers to report, and I hate to see that we are moving our state in a direction that could further impede people's opportunity for work. Some of the ideas proposed by this bill, where the question has not been able to be answered, for instance, on the irrigation districts, I asked to find out how many irrigation districts actually sell their water to these projects. We don't know that. How much property within an irrigation district isn't irrigated? We don't know that. The policy reason for actually choosing the irrigation district is also probably unknown. I think we are unfairly targeting rural Oregon as off limits to economic opportunity. Some of us here at the dais reside in districts where you probably couldn't change the zoning for a hot dog stand because your entire district is developed. It's homes, it's businesses, it's parking lots, it's all those things. And at one time or another, to get there, the people who owned that land and who lived there had an economic opportunity for which they were able to proceed. This bill, I think, puts us on a slippery slope towards saying, if you come from a district fully developed, we're in good shape. We got to take advantage of that opportunity, and we have benefited from it. If you're in a district that has land that has not had that development or that opportunity, we don't want you to have the same opportunity. And I think that's a very, very slippery slope. Land use planning is terribly important, and I agree to that premise. Oregon has benefited by common sense land use. This may be taking that too far and unfairly penalizing rural Oregon in its wake.
Members, we have another bill on the dais, and I think that it's pretty clear what's happening with this bill. So I would ask some respect for the people who have come, some of them quite some distance, to testify on the second bill, that we keep our comments brief. Representative Greenlit?
I agree to be so far. I'm trying to continue that. Madam Chair, I just felt compelled to comment that the minority leader has come very close to interpreting my motives or the motives of those of us that are from urban districts, and I have a problem with that. I can say there's lots of controversy in my district over land use decisions, and particularly among the extent to which we create economic opportunities or residential versus farm and other land, and it's an important issue. I think I'll be happy to talk about what my motive is in voting for this bill, and it's that I think it does provide clarity in the process as to how it would be possible to move a destination resort in places where destination resorts ought to be by common consent. And I think that that sense of clarity is enough to make me feel comfortable supporting the bill.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Esquivel, one
minute.
Yes,
very brief. We spend about $10 million a year to invite tourists to this state. $10 million a year. And now we're going to say, come on to Oregon. Come to Oregon. Unfortunately, we've taken away a lot of the places you can go, but please come to Oregon. Maybe we should reevaluate what we're spending our money on.
Thank you. I do think we need to clarify, because there have been some suggestions about either the motives of members of this committee, and they have come out of the mouths of the people who are not the ones being described, and also about the integrity of the process, which I think need to be clarified. Let's remember that there are two ways by which a destination resort may be sited in Oregon. There's the regular way that every other business, every other land use goes through. And in that one did not provide the kind of support for tourism that the economic development interests of the state found effective. So several years ago, we created a shortcut. And what we are doing with this bill is simply updating that shortcut. We are saying, if this normal process that everybody else goes through is too slow, too cumbersome, whatever for you, we've created a special route for destination resorts, and we are updating that. The purpose here is to update that and support tourism while at the same time protecting other economic development activities in the state, most notably farming, which is a major portion of our economy. It's clear that on this committee there's some disagreement about whether that updating is timely or appropriate, or the scope of it. Although I'm actually pleased that the disagreement is rather narrow, because the difference between the Dash 9 and the Dash 10 amendment is pretty small. It's significant, not immaterial, but the two amendments are relatively close to each other, and so we are now at a point of debating just a few fine points of the bill. And I don't think further debate is going to change any votes on the amendment or the bill, but we have had an opportunity to express different points of view. So now, please call the roll on the motion to move the bill as amended to the floor.
Representative Klein.
Aye.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Representative Greenland.
Aye.
Representative Hammond.
No.
Representative Wingard.
No.
Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
No.
Chair Nolan.
Yes. Motion carries. I will carry the bill. Thank you for the discussion, and to all of you who have come and participated both in our hearings and in our work sessions, I appreciate the input that you have given us. The bill has evolved quite significantly because of the input that we've had, and I think it is a better bill than when we started. So I'm going to close that work session and open a public hearing on House Bill 3099. Representative Clem, it's your bill.
So, Johnson.
Mr. Cleave, would you like to come up to the witness table, too? And Mr. Johnson, are you in the room? There you are.
I'm going to steal your
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, I know this isn't your bill, but I wanted you to be here as an expert for us so that if there are implications that we needed to be able to understand, you could help us with that. So thank you for accepting my invitation to join us. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Brian Clem, State Representative from here in Salem, House District 21, and Chair of the House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. There is a section of our statutes that I've been alluding to repeatedly since we began, and the bill's finally in a form to bring to this committee for consideration. The work product here, represented in House Bill 3099, comes from a project that I engaged in during the interim for more hours than these two and a lot of others would like to have probably been there, but I mean we're talking 40, 50 hours worth of meetings, going through the EFU statute, exclusive farm use statute, looking at the exceptions and exemptions and things that are allowed but with a conditional use, things that are allowed but in an outright manner, and proposing changes to the statute. What you'll probably find is there's some people who disagree. They kind of like it the way it is. You'll probably hear from them, so I think it's completely worthy of debate. But this is my best offering at what each, and it's there's a pretty long list of them. That's part of the thing that drives farmers crazy. What each exemption, exception, or allowance ought to look like. And I've brought some technical and philosophical help to the table with me to help walk through each of the provisions, if you'd like, because it's going to take some time, and would like to have a good understanding why we came up with what we did, and I put my name on it at the request of the Oregon Farm Bureau.
I think that's your cue, Mr. Cleave.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave. I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau, and I guess the philosophical end of the spectrum that Representative Clem alluded to. 3099 is a product of a work group that was hosted at Representative Clem's graces, I guess, because it was quite a bit of time we put in. Essentially, what the bill is a reflection of our attempt to take I hesitate to say unbiased because obviously everybody has some bias, but to take an agricultural perspective look at the exclusive farm use statute and look at it for two things. One, ways that we can minimize conflict, and two, ways that we can reduce the amount of farmland in Oregon that is going to other uses. I've testified in this committee before regarding some of those uses and also the Farm Bureau's philosophy regarding the importance of having an agricultural base to allow that micro economy to exist. Farmers share tools, they swap land, they are collaborative in the crops they grow. These are very hard things to identify and put into some sort of economic model. It's been tried before. I believe Oregon State University is actually engaged in a project, but put quite simply, the farmers on the ground know where these conflicts exist, and this bill is a reflection of that. I've submitted my testimony. The testimony is my introduction, a discussion on what will happen to uses that would be eliminated under House Bill 3099 under ORS 2115-130. That's the non-conforming use statute. It's a bulleted and condensed reflection of that statute. And also some information on exactly what the bill does. And I'd be more than happy to go through some of these if the chair wishes. I know there are a lot of people that have come from over the mountain. So I just want to throw that out for you.
And Mr. Cleave, since we have the opportunity to see you quite often, and some of these good folks we don't get to see very often, I would prefer if you wouldn't mind being available to us either at a subsequent hearing or at a work session.
That's
for the
quite
details.
All right.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Mr. Johnson, do you have opening comments or just want to be available for
Chair, no, I mean, I have no real opening comments. I wasn't really planning on testifying on behalf of the department, but to be available here. But I will say that the Department of Agriculture, along with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, did participate in Representative Lim's work group. There's some real basic elements in terms of issues that farmers have dealt with in land use that are really can be seen in some of these proposed amendments, and I'd be happy to talk about those as they come up and answer any questions.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative, yes.
Just one framework for people as you hear your public testimony, colleagues. There are kind of three, two chapters or sub-chapters, I guess would be the phrase. Sub 1, sub 2, and if you're not in either one of those, then you are left to the exceptions process. So as you hear people talking about things, if somebody says, I love the fact that you've moved this one from sub 1 to sub 2, we could walk through what that means, but it's taken myself and my staff a long time to understand this whole sub 1, sub 2, and then if you're not in those and someone else said, we're banned, that's not true, you can use the exceptions process. But if you want clarification later, we can do it. But there's Jim is the right person to ask to explain those nuances to give you some framework of what that means, sub 1, sub 2, and exception.
Okay, that would be the technical side of your presentation.
Correct, right.
Okay. Did anyone want discussion about that?
If Chair Nolan, if you'd like, I could maybe take 60 seconds to basically, I think, address what
I think that's a great
saying.
Idea. Thank you.
The exclusive farm use zone has two sections that pertain to two sets of counties. 215-213 deals with marginal land counties, which are Lane and Washington counties. 215-283 deals with the rest of the state of Oregon. Most of the focus tends to be, of course, on 215-283 because it's the vast majority of the state, but the two sections tend to mirror each other. I'm going to just refer to 283 so that but what I say would also apply to 213. In the exclusive farm use statute, Representative Clem is correct. There is 215-283 sub 1 uses and 215-283 sub 2 uses. Sub 1 uses are uses that may be permitted subject to review against what is ever in state statute, period. No local additions can be added to that. It's basically reviewed against whatever specific in that section of the statute. They are also not subject to any review against 215-296 unless specifically called out, and that is important because 215-296 are the standards that basically ask for a non-farm use to be reviewed for its compatibility with agricultural uses. 215-283 sub 2, the other set of uses, are what, as a term of art, a lot of people call those conditional uses. Those are uses that are subject to the review against compatibility with agricultural practices and subject to any local standards that local governments may employ, and that could be anything from traffic to compatibility with residential use to whatever. It's all over the place. It really deals with what are some of the local issues. And that's really how it works in a nutshell. A lot of the issues are that many of the uses in the sub 1 category are not reviewed for their implications to agriculture, and there's been a push over the years that some of those should be moved over into the sub 2 category.
And
you're not going to ask me to repeat that, are you?
No, and believe me, I've been at this a long time. And the last category, as Representative Clem pointed out, is there in state law, unless something specifically says that you cannot take an exception. In other words, it says you cannot take an exception for a widget factory any place. You can propose an exception for a use in any zone in the state of Oregon. So the exceptions process is always available unless the law specifically precludes it.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
We have about 18 folks to testify, so I am going to ask, I'm going to have the two-minute rule so that we can hear from all of them with the time available. So I will call to the witness table Mike Wagner, Stephen Kafouri, and Bruce Chapin. Next panel will be Ed Chotard, Jim Gilbert, and John DiLorenzo. 2 minutes. Mr. Wagner?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Wagner. I reside at 26173 South Milk Creek, Molino, Oregon. I wanted to stand and support this bill, 3099.
Thank you.
I think it's an important piece of the puzzle to preserve Oregon farmland. I think that these 50 uses kind of eat away every day at our important farmland and Oregon's food shed. So I think the bill is worthy of support. I am concerned also, and I know that the state is also concerned, that the existing 20-year comprehensive plan process requires cities to take a bite out of rural and farmland almost every 5 years or so. So I am very supportive of the state's process that they've outlined for the Portland metropolitan area with the counties of Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah regarding their urban and rural process that they are working on, and I hope that that will be a successful process where rural areas will be designated for 45 or 50 years. The reason I'm before you today is because in our community we've had two recent proposals for sand and gravel extraction in what is otherwise a pristine rural valley. And this it has had farms and fences on it for the last 162 years, and it, without buildings on it, it's been there for thousands of years. This area was one of the first original homesteads of the Oregon in Molalla along the a river. And the last thing I'd like to say is that a lot of times when we're talking about farms, we kind of gloss over the aesthetic qualities that aren't discussed very much, but Oregon has some of the most beautiful farms in the world. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Kafouri.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafouri. The unusual position of representing two clients today on this bill with slightly different takes. I'll take the first one as the land use planners, the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. We've been looking for a bill like this for a while, and we're very pleased that Representative Clem's come forth with a bill, and we are, in general, very supportive of where you're going with it. I also like to make comment on behalf of Trust for Public Land. Trust for Public Land is a national land trust. It's the biggest trust in the country. I work for the Oregon part of that organization. We work for conserving land. We purchase land from willing sellers and sell land to government agencies for conservation purposes. Some of the land that we buy sometimes is farmland. We often keep the land or ensure that the land is kept in farming after it's gone into public hands, but it might run the risk, in the, Madam Chair, of running afoul of the preservation of farmland, the extensive parks. There's a statement in the bill that says you cannot change farmland to parks. I think people, when they think of parks, have sometimes different views of what a park is, swings and play sets and baseball fields. Parkland can also be open space. It can be natural habitat. Parks, it can be areas that are preserved for other reasons than we think of when we think of recreation-type parks. I would ask that you would delete that one section of the bill on behalf of public land.
Thank you. Mr. Chapin.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the Land Use Committee, I'm Bruce Chapin. I reside at 9965 Wheatland Road, North Salem, Oregon. I'm a third generation to farm just in the Mission Bottom area, just north of Kaiser. I was part of the interim work group that proposed this bill. I serve as chairman of the Oregon Farm Bureau Special Agriculture Committee, and in 2004 through 2007, I represent Oregon Farm Bureau in the agriculture consensus process set up by the governor. Although the process did not to resolve the issue, we did learn a lot, and a lot of that is reflected in the brochure that I've passed out before you. The exclusive farm use zone is not very exclusive. As has been mentioned, it allows 57 other uses competing with us in the zone. House Bill 3099 addresses several of those. I'm going to limit my comments strictly to the aggregate issue, because diluvial aggregate mining in the Willamette Valley is a very big competing use. It's consuming between 200 and 400 acres of farmland, of prime farmland in the Willamette Valley. Let me help you visualize how big that is. A city lot, in our city block, excuse me, in the city of Salem is about 4 acres. You have in your packet a map of the city of Salem. This represents 400 acres inside that square. The northwest corner is the intersection of Front Street and Division. The southeast corner is the intersection of 12th Street. Thank you. 12th Street and Pringle Parkway. The question is not are we going to mine aggregate, but whether from where are we going to mine it. We must recognize that there's both a need for aggregate and the mining of aggregate is a consumptive industry. We need to direct the industry to mine on our poor soils, and the Oregon's three permitting processes do not accomplish that. Madam Chair,
wrap up, please.
Pardon?
Wrap up, please.
Well, I'll just drop to the back page, if you don't mind. House Bill 3099 is a very moderate approach to the problem. It does not exclude the mining of aggregate in the IFU zone. It allows the mining as under the current rules on our poor soils. On our better soils, it simply asks that they go through an alternatives process. Basic logic. Currently, the counties are not allowed to look at this factor. Under the Goal 5 process, it is a mandatory direct that if the site contains rock,
This is wrapping up, Mr. Chapin.
Yeah, okay. If it contains rock, if it meets the criteria of Goal 5, the counties must permit the site. And so they do not have the option to look at the value of the soil and be able to move the industry to this point to do the least amount of damage.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, thank you. Ted Chotard, Jim Gilbert, John DiLorenzo. Next up, we will have Rich Angstrom, Kevin Wolf, and Paul Rabernick. Mr. Chotard?
Good afternoon, Chairwoman Nolan and committee members. For the record, I am Ed Chotard, President of Jefferson County Farm Bureau, Madras, Oregon. Jefferson County Farm Bureau supports House Bill 3099. Our County Farm Bureau believes strongly in protecting the agricultural land base. This bill not only does that, but it cleans up some of the land uses currently allowed outright in an exclusive farm use zone that honestly should not be in that zone since they have nothing to do with farming. It also requires that certain non-farm uses currently not reviewed for their impacts to agriculture be reviewed against criteria that are aimed at ensuring compatibility with farm uses before being approved in an exclusive farm use zone. This bill allows for more transparent and local review of uses that have been deleted from Sub 1 outright to be reviewed through ORS 215-130, which is for non-conforming uses. The true strength of this bill is that it allows for a review of the impacts that any potential approval may have on agriculture before the use will be approved and allowed in an EFU zone. The Big Look Task Force has said that more local control is a key to updating Oregon's land use system. Representative Clem's interim work group that worked on this cleanup was doing a proactive internal review of the EFU zone and allowed uses, and looked at what uses should be moved to Sub 2 and provided clarity on siting criteria for certain uses, schools, temporary hardship dwellings if approved for an EFU zone. A major component of a Measure 49 campaign was about protecting agriculture, and this bill is another step towards doing that. The bill strengthens each of Oregon's government agencies' abilities to protect the EFU zone to provide food, fiber, fuel, habitat for wildlife, as well as an aid in reducing greenhouse gases for Oregonians today and future generations. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Gilbert?
Chair Nolan, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gilbert. I live in Clackamas County near Molalla. I've been farming, making my living farming for 30 years, and am chair of the Molalla Community Planning Organization. Our organization represents farmers and woodland owners and other residents in the rural area around the city of Molalla. And we thank you very much for considering this bill, which would restrict the trend to convert farmland to non-farm uses. We consider farmland to be our most long-lasting and valuable asset, both for our region and for our state. It's obvious with the concerns about global warming, climate change, local food production, that preserving and protecting our farmland is important for many, many generations to come. Sadly, human beings don't have a really good track record of thinking far in the future and making sacrifices today for the benefit of future generations. But I think this is a really good example of something we can do to help those people that will follow us. We have heard testimony in the past about the cost of gravel and whether it might cost us an extra dollar or two per yard to bring gravel to more distant locations. But I question, how do you put a price on farmland when it's destroyed forever? We've had experience in our region with gravel pits. We actually were able to defeat a gravel mine proposal that would have taken 100 acres of prime farmland and make it into a 100-acre pond. This was a difficult battle to win, and we only won it because we had county commissioners who were willing to listen to our side of the story and to agree with us. Unfortunately, that's not going to always be the case. And another issue that came up for us with that is the problem of not having a level playing field, and when local citizens, rural residents that don't have a lot of money have to go up against developers and proponents that have deep pockets and teams of lawyers. Basically, we need your support in helping us to protect our farmland and our livelihoods. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. DiLorenzo.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner at the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I am here on behalf of my client, Western Fireworks Display. You're all very familiar, I think, with the business of Western from our discussion regarding House Bill 2375. We applied for and received a conditional use permit from Clackamas County to operate in an EFU zone by virtue of 215.283(2)(y). And the bill at page 14 eliminates that section, thereby converting our conditional use to a non-conforming use. And although the statute provides some benefits to our property as a non-conforming use, we would be forever prejudiced when we sought financing. Most lenders, especially in today's climate, do not favor loans to parties located in non-conforming use areas. The impact can range from no loans at all to loans of lesser amounts to higher basis points and spreads and the likes. We are proposing an amendment, which you have before you, which would allow our operation, and frankly all those that are disallowed under this bill, to continue to make alterations based on the footprint. In other words, the land that they happen to own, and we just set a date, January 1, 2009, to prevent others from taking advantage of the bill and trying to accumulate farmland once it passed. But we would take the footprint, whatever you own, as of January 1, 2009, and then allow further expansions, provided those expansions took place through the conditional use permit process, which would allow neighbors and others to testify as to whether those uses could be compatible with farming uses in the area. Under no circumstances would parties be able to acquire more farmland. It is my understanding that the purpose of the bill is to prevent those people from gobbling up farmland. I think this would do it. It would be a very fair transition tool. It would cause us to support the bill, and it might assuage the concerns of the others who are also treated as non-conforming uses. So we commend it for your consideration.
Thank you. Rich Engstrom, Kevin Wolf, and Paul Robernick. On deck, we'll have Dave Honeycutt. Peter Kinesi and Marge Easley. Mr. Angstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rich Angstrom, and I'm
use
the president
a mic.
Of the Oregon Conference.
Mr. Angstrom, could you please use a mic?
Aggregate so Producers
record all
Association.
Your pearls of wisdom.
And I represent the construction materials, sand and gravel, asphalt, concrete, cement, and admixture industries. We oppose House Bill 3099. We are also not part of the work group, and this has a significant impact on the aggregate businesses. I think it's important to understand a little bit about how we fit into the land use system, which is a little bit different than some of the other permitted uses. We will exist, our industry will exist, as a resource use on lands in Oregon that are zoned EFU or forest. And we will not, you won't find us necessarily in new sites around housing developments and things of that nature because of the conflicts. So we are a resource industry. And when the land use system came into effect, they realized that you can't really tell where all the aggregate and mineral resources are going to be. So they put us in the permitted uses section. And that's important because we never know where we're going to find the type of material that's going to meet specifications and provide durable, high quality, and high quantity of aggregate material. Aggregate is a huge issue in front of the legislature. There's no question. It's been an issue the 12 years I've been here. But there's been a lot of happenings in it. In 1996, Governor Kitzhaber put together a work group and mediated a settlement out that resulted in a 10-point agreement that the Farm Bureau and OCAPA testified in favor of. This bill flies in the face of that. One of the things that I think is important is that aggregate policy should be focused. If this committee looks at land use around aggregate, we should focus on the big policy pieces. We like to mine deep, and one of the policy considerations is mining deep provides the highest quality and the most rock instead of mining in a broad depth. That was one of the policy considerations. Keeping the mines close to the communities to make affordable aggregate material was another big consideration. And the end use, turning it back into fish and wildlife or converting it back to farmland, was one of the other balance pieces. The effect of this bill is essentially to eliminate aggregate mining on land zoned for EFU and precludes it from the best quality, highest quantity of aggregate material in the state. And I think that was my bell.
I think that was your bell.
I will conclude. We oppose this this bill. It's not good aggregate policy. It lets one side control the issue. It impacts adversely at transportation costs. It impacts Oregon businesses. And Oregon cannot afford to have an anti-aggregate position while they have a pro-transportation policy in this state. Thank you.
Madam Chair, would I be able to ask a question maybe after the end of the panel?
I'm sure that Mr. Angstrom would be happy to hang around.
I will.
Mr. Wolf?
Madam Chair, my name is Kevin Wolf. I am Technical Services Manager for Cal Cortland, formerly Glacier Northwest, largest concrete aggregate and cement producer supplier in the Pacific Northwest. My job is to cover the Northwest and give technical support. My history with the company and in the industry is 30 years of concrete aggregates and materials testing, concrete mix design, and production. So my expertise is how to make the stuff and what materials we use. This bill is going to impact our ability to mine and use, therefore, alluvial aggregates. So it will change our industry to cause us to require to use a crushed material, primarily basalt, perhaps. There are other materials around. At issue with that is the technical impact that has on concrete. Roughly speaking, and very quickly, just going over that, the quality of the aggregate greatly influences the quality of the end product, the concrete. Crushed aggregate is much more angular, okay? Leaves more voids in between the materials. Those voids require water and cement to be filled, okay? So when we make a concrete with a crushed material, it will require more cementitious material content and more water in order to fill those voids and make a workable product. That drives the water content up. The cement content rises at 2.5 times the rate of the water content. the end effect of using crushed materials, primarily in concrete, will be an increase in roughly 2 to 2.5 pounds of cement. 2 to 2.5 pounds of cement in per pound of water, or about 60 pounds of cement per yard of concrete. To accomplish the same water to cement ratio, our industry is under big scrutiny right now for CO2. Every pound of cementitious material is a pound of CO2 emitted to accomplish that concrete, plus the haulage, plus the CO2 to crush the aggregates, etc. So we have a very large CO2 potential impact in the concrete itself. All rocks are just not the same. The quality greatly influences the product, and crushed aggregates decreases the overall quality of the concrete. So we will significantly increase the CO2 by doing this.
Thank you.
Chairman Nolan and the members of the committee, I'm Paul Gribernick. My business address is 805 South West Broadway, Portland, Oregon, 97205. I'm here because I cite mineral and aggregate resources. That's what I do for a living in 19 counties over the past 20 years. I've cited several of these things, and so I'm here to give you some practical advice on what this bill does to the thing. I have 3 points. One, the current Goal 5 provisions are tough, despite what Mr. Chapin says. Two, gravel is an infinitesimally small portion of the problem that's facing you. Three, the exceptions process that you have in this bill is a de facto ban on gravel in the Willamette Valley. First point, Mr. Chapin says that the county finds that there's a good gravel source there, the county government has to approve it. That's wrong. That's demonstrably false. There's a very difficult process that was balanced in Governor Kitzhaber's 1996 process. Let me give you a few things here. Westside Rock, Clackamas County, $1 million spent in permitting, permit denied. Malala MMR in Clackamas County, permit denied. Copeland, Josephine County, permit denied. Smith, Multnomah County, permit denied. Eugene Sand and Gravel, $2 million plus in permitting, permit denied. Delta Sand and Gravel, Lane County, permit denied. Beaver State, Douglas County, permit denied. Myers, Columbia County, permit denied. Aylott, Umatilla County, permit denied. Glacier, Columbia County, 20 years, including 2 times up to the Court of Appeals, permit finally granted. Dave Friel, independent grantier in Jackson County, 12 years in the Goal 5 process, 2 trips to Luba, 2 trips to the Court of Appeals, finally approved. If that's not a tough process, that's what we have. Mr. Chapin's here telling you that it's easy. That's not correct. Second point. You're going to have to deal with a problem that's difficult because both what Rich says is both gravel and farmland are the same. They're in the same location. There's a conflict there, and we understand that. But you're going to also have to start dealing with some of the real issues. And I'm going to give you, I'll send this over. These are 2 reports from Oregon State University. They were done in 2005. It's the best data that's available. You need to read it because it's very important. But a couple of things. One, Class 2, 3, and 4, there's 1,081,000 acres in the Willamette Valley. In the next 35 years, so it's through 2050, we'll use 0.5% of that land for gravel. And second statistic that you need to know about, Marion County alone, 4,000 acres in churches, dwellings, commercial uses, and schools on high-value farmland between 1993 and 2004. Gravel during the same period, 400 acres.
Last point.
Thank you, Mr. Angstrom. I don't need
The bill does, to the gravel industry, does 2 things. It creates an exception process, which I'm telling you as a land use practitioner, a gravel permit cannot be obtained in that situation, period. No doubt about it. The client comes to me and says, I want to do this under the new bill. I say, go spend your money elsewhere. Go to Hawaii. Take your business to Washington. Second, you're trying to jam gravel.
Can't have 2 last points.
It's the same point.
Well, then you've made it.
I'll be quiet, Representative Nolan. Thanks.
Thank you.
I get wound up.
Thank you for your testimony.
May I provide this to the...
Please, that would be helpful. System.
Thanks.
Mr. Hoyt will take it and distribute it. Mr. Honeycutt?
May I ask a question or no?
I'm going to ask Rich to hang around till the end of the hearing because I do have other people who've waited a long time to testify, and Mr. Angstrom, I'm sure, would be happy to revisit. Peter Kanasi and Marge Easley. Next up will be Kate Kimball, Kathleen Hunter, and Randy Tucker. Mr. Honeycutt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, and here, as you can expect, in opposition to House Bill 3099. One thing that I do like about the bill, and I thank the sponsor for putting this in, is the language in Section 18, which I assume is intended to treat existing uses not as nonconforming, but with whatever status they had at the time that they were originally approved. If that's the case, then we won't have to worry about the existing uses being treated as nonconforming, which certainly does, as I think Mr. DiLorenzo indicated, have a significant effect on the ability to make changes to those existing uses and also to obtain financing for those existing uses. Other than that, for us, there's not a whole lot to like in 3099. I will submit written comments because I know we're short on time, and I appreciate the two-minute time limit as well. I wish that they would do this in local land use hearings, which I'd go on until 4 in the morning. I look at the different
I'll
uses.
I'll co-sponsor that bill with you, Mr.
Yeah, absolutely. I look at the uses that are being eliminated by this bill, some of which I had something to do with. Landfills, dog kennels, model airplane clubs, living history museums, spring water bottling operations, fireworks businesses. None of those are going into the Pearl. Okay, those are going into rural areas. And the problem that we've had, and you've heard me say it over and over again, is we have managed in this state to zone 97% of our privately owned rural land as in farm or forest zones. So if you're going to have a rural use, like the six that I just mentioned, the chances are that it will go into a resource zone. It's going to go in a farm zone or a forest zone. That's the only option that you have, unless, as Representative Glenn says, you take an exception, and the three types of exceptions, built exceptions, committed exceptions, and reasons exceptions. Mr. Riverneck was being gentle when he described those as impossible. I've done those in the non-aggregate context, and I will tell you that impossible is putting it kindly. The language of private parks, I can't believe I agree with Mr. Kafori on something, but I do agree with Mr. Kafori on the language of private parks. That language needs to be changed significantly. We talk about active or passive uses in private parks, and that's in the definition. If I take my family out for a picnic, but they play volleyball, are we engaged in a passive use or an active use? There's all kinds of language in that. Well, that will cause endless headaches for lawyers and the counties and clients when trying to figure out what it is that you intended.
And we will look forward to your
testimony. Oh, and my
time's
up. Yes,
sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kanacki?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Kanacki. I'm a full-time farmer from Benton County. I sat on Clem's work, many Representative Clem's work sessions that this bill came out of. House Bill 3099 is a very modest attempt to remove some of the more minor non-compatible uses from the EFU zone that are currently allowed in the EFU zone. I think the most important part of the bill, and I think particularly for agriculture, is the part that relates to aggregate, and it's obviously going to be the most controversial. I'm a past 12-year veteran of the Benton County Planning Commission. I sat through multiple hearings for a Goal 5 PAPA application for aggregate. It is an expensive process. But it is also a process that is stacked in favor of the aggregate industry at this point. And the fundamental fact is that there are alternatives to mining aggregate, alluvial aggregate, from our best soils. And that's what this bill tries to accomplish. We're not prohibiting it. We're saying you have to prove that there aren't better alternatives. And I don't think that's too much to ask when we're dealing with a finite resource that is extremely valuable and will be extremely valuable to future generations. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Easley.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Marjorie Easley, and I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I am here today because the League has long been concerned about the preservation of Oregon's farmland. And it is very alarming that it is being lost at a great rate. We previously commented on this issue during the 2007 legislative session as well as in February of 2008, and largely this was based on the League's participation as the public representative to the Aggregate Farmland Consensus Group. So we are limiting our comments today on the aggregate issue alone on this bill, although we may be commenting at a later time on other parts of the bill. Liz Franco and I were the two League representatives to that group. The League believes that both the aggregate and the farming industries supply a public need now and in the future, and we believe in the importance of both of those industries. However, we reject the idea that gravel extraction on high-value farmland is in the public's best interest. It is long past time for more studies, task forces, and more looks at this, because we already have a great deal of information. And I alone have sat through many, many hours of sifting through that information. We already know there's no shortage of rock in Oregon, and that in many cases the rock that comes from the alluvial soils is not inherently better than quarry rock. And that there are economically viable ways to transport rock from farther distances. And most importantly, we already know that we are losing 200 to 400 acres of farmland in the Willamette Valley to aggregate mining each year. We need the political will to preserve our Class 1 and 2 soils before they're lost forever. And we thank you for listening. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Let's ask, invite Kate Kimball, Kathleen Hunter, and Randy Tucker. Next panel will be Lori Freeman Swanson, Paul Mather, and Sam Sweeney. Ms. Kimball.
Thank you, Chair Nolan, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Kimball, and I'm here today on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3099, and I've given you some detailed comments on that. I just wanted to do a small visual of the uses allowed in the EFU zone. We sort of hear about it, but these are largely non-farm uses allowed in the EFU zone. This bill eliminates six of them, a couple of which I believe have never been used. So I think this is a step in the right direction. This bill also does just make some common sense for a few things. For example, one of the changes in the bill is that schools sited on EFU should serve, on EFU land, should serve primarily rural students, which makes sense to me that a school sited in a rural area would serve primarily rural students. Temporary hardship dwellings, those are dwellings on EFU that are temporary in case of a medical hardship to help farmers in need. Those dwellings have tended to turn into secondary permanent structures, which really compromises the value of this category of classes. There's a valid reason to have these temporary hardship dwellings, and we'd like to see that class protected and kept its integrity. Aggregate mining, you have heard about. We strongly support changes in the bill, and I have some suggested language that addresses the alternative language that simply says that if you can go someplace other than the best soils, do so. If you can't, you can mine on these soils. I think that's a pretty common sense kind of approach. Non-farm dwellings should be sited in a way to minimize interference with agricultural activity on that parcel. Again, this really isn't rocket science. It's better not to put a non-farm dwelling in the middle of an operating farm so you can still farm. So I appreciate that this bill has really moved forward in a pretty modest but practical step to protect agricultural land for something like farming. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Brennan Hunter, or did you want to start?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, here in my frequent role as butler or Vanna White or caddy for one of my more illustrious colleagues to tee it up. I think caddy might be the most appropriate. I want to make sure that you that I walk you through the three pieces of material that we've distributed to you. You have my colleague Kathleen Brennan Hunter to my left, your right, her testimony. You have a brochure about Metro's natural area bond measure that was passed in 2006, and in the middle of that, you have probably the most important piece, which is a resolution that was passed by the Metro Council prior to the election in 2006. To introduce what Kathleen's going to talk to you about, I just wanted to summarize how we've gotten to the point we're at. In 1995, Metro, Portland area voters actually approved a $135 million bond measure to purchase natural areas and open spaces and park areas in the Portland metropolitan region. And in 2006, the voters approved another $227 million on a measure that was called the Natural Areas, Parks and Streams Campaign. In all of this work of land acquisition, Metro has proceeded on a willing seller basis. The Metro Council has decided not to invoke the right of eminent domain to obtain any property, but instead is working with individual landowners around the region to negotiate acquisitions at fair market value based on independent appraisals. And so far, we've protected about 9,000 acres. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you. Prior to the 2006, Kathleen Brennan Hunter, I'm the director of Metro's Natural Areas Program. And prior to the 2006 election that Mr. Tucker mentioned, there were concerns that were raised by some members of the agricultural community about Metro's land acquisition program. And in response to that, the Metro Council, which took those concerns very seriously, they passed a resolution giving us very specific direction about how we were going to operate the land acquisition program within these agricultural areas. And that's the resolution that you have in front of you. We've taken this very seriously. In agricultural areas, we always offer conservation easements first. Only if someone doesn't want to sell us a conservation easement do we look at fee title. Public access is explicitly prohibited on those conservation easements where they're purchased for the purpose of water quality or habitat protection. And when we are purchasing agricultural land, we're identifying habitat that's important. We're actively striving to continue agricultural production. We're going to place conservation easements on the water quality and habitat parts of the property that we want to protect and then resell the agricultural land so that it can stay in production. And most importantly, we're committed to actively working with the agricultural community in the development of our acquisition plans and in an ongoing conversation as we're acquiring land in these areas. And it's a commitment we're taking seriously. We're hoping that our efforts to accommodate these concerns demonstrate a good faith effort. And we certainly don't want the acquisition to undermine the agricultural economy in our region. And because of that, and combined with the fact that public parks are currently conditional use rather than outright use, we think that current law provides us sufficient protection. For these reasons, we oppose a blanket prohibition on the establishment of public parks designated as high-value farmland. And we have requested an amendment, which we'll think is not in front of you yet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if they're eligible to stay after the for a while or not, but I had one question, if I could, just for the last speaker.
Go ahead.
Just wondered, you referenced an amendment, and I think the amendment is just to basically remove a reference to you all in the bill at all, so you're just left with the existing statute. Does that sound right?
Mr. Chair, may I answer that, Mr. Vice Chair? Now, Representative Clem, yes, we requested an amendment that deletes, I believe, it's line 11 on page 12, and then the accompanying formatting. So that's correct. It would leave us with the conditional use process that we currently have, which in our region anyway has worked well.
Follow up?
Yep.
So you talked about this council resolution, and there's some different things that you've done to really work with agriculture, and I'm wondering if you could support, instead of deleting it, adopting all these provisions you've created for all park purchases so we can model. In fact, I don't think it would affect you at all, probably, because you've already adopted it, but model this kind of partnership for purchasing parks all over the state.
Can you just clarify the questions away? I'd be happy to.
Sure. The you talked about this resolution that was passed that put in a bunch of standards for how you work with farmers,
right.
And I'm wondering if you could support an amendment that took your standards and placed those in the state statute so they could be used all over the state.
We would definitely be happy to discuss that.
I don't think I can follow up. That was we'll be happy to discuss
yes,
it. We're sort of got the gavels and things here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lori Freeman Swanson and Paul Mather and Sam Sweeney.
Good afternoon. My name is Lori Freeman Swanson. I own a 235-acre farm in Molalla. It's been in my family for 88 years. I'm also a member of a family that up until a few years ago designed and manufactured farm implements, the primary pieces being the Freeman Hay Baler and Freeman Loader. I'm also president of the Molalla Irrigation Company. I am in support of this bill wholeheartedly. I would like to just relay my story as quick as I can here. For the past 8 years, myself and my neighbors have been opposing three different gravel applications that are directly adjacent to my farm. So far, all of those applications were denied. The 8 years were taken because of persistent appeals by the gravel companies, and at each level they were denied. We prevailed at all levels. This was all at great expense, hundreds of thousands of dollars to myself and surrounding farmers and the city downstream concerned about water intake from the Molalla River that supplies their population. These concerns are very real. In arguing my case, a neighbor and I interviewed neighboring farmers in an existing area with a very large wet mining operation. The first thing that we would speak to in terms of neighbors, asking neighbors about saying what their experiences have been, would be water. Their water table was lowered and contaminated. The second thing they would be mentioning would be dust and noise. Again, difficulty in raising crops and hardship to animals and natural habitat distribution. At this point in time, a denial means that the mining company must wait 2 years before reapplying, so they can continue to apply over and over and over, as in wearing down or bankrupting neighboring farmers, of course, then leaving other farms by the way. As far as the irrigation company, the experience we've had over the 8 years was a great lack of cooperation from the mining companies in trying to design a situation to save our irrigation ditches from being contaminated, since our responsibility is to return the water to the river in good kind and to maintain water for all the shareholders.
We're going to have to hold to our time limit, so thank you
yes.
very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Vice Chair, committee members, my name is Sam Sweeney. I reside at 1070 Perry Street, Dayton, Oregon. Our family has farmed the Dayton area for a number of years. We grow a wide variety of crops. What I'd like to talk about this afternoon is how the present regulations really favor the gravel companies. We have a lot of land down next to the Willamette River adjacent to it. And there's been the last 10 or so years, there's been really a push to develop those lands for gravel extraction. And to kind of illustrate that, let me tell you a little more detail what that means. First of all, there's 169 acres down in what we call Lambert Bend Bottom. That that application was approved. It took 10% of the area. Really great soils, all irrigatable, valuable. What we call class 1 and class 2 soils that grow any wide variety of crops. Shortly after that, there was a 455-acre application on Grand Island. That took 10 to 12% of the entire island that will be developed. And then shortly after that, right across the river from us in Marion County, there's another 160 acres that the application was approved. So in a matter of 4 river miles, there was nearly 700 or a little over 700 acres that were approved for gravel extraction. Now, these aren't class 5 and 6 soils. These are class 1 and 2 soils that are removed from agriculture. For them, when all that soil is gone, that's the last harvest. You'll never see any agricultural commodity ever produced again on those soils. So that's one of the reasons why we're really concerned about this. And the present regulations, we've lost more soil, more agricultural soil base to gravel extraction than we have to subdivisions and the enlargement of the area around towns. I can't think of the name of it. But anyway, it's a big use, and we're just really, really concerned about it. So we're totally in favor of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, regional manager for ODOT, is here to share with you a few thoughts from ODOT's perspective. Probably not to a surprise to any of you, ODOT is a large user of aggregate in building and maintaining Oregon's highways. Whether it's resurfacing roadways, building bridges, or simply putting sand out on icy roadways, we are dependent on high quality and a high volume of aggregate. With over half our construction program in the Willamette Valley, limitations on the availability of aggregate would significantly increase the cost of highway projects in our program. While ODOT owns some material sources, we're primarily dependent on commercial sources for our aggregate. By reducing the number of aggregate sources in the Willamette Valley, the number of bidders for ODOT's projects would be reduced. When competition is reduced, we see our prices go up. For example, when we receive 2 bids or less on a project, typically we see our prices 8% above our estimate. On the other side, when we have 9 or more bidders on a project, typically we see see prices 13% less than our estimate. One of the largest cost components in aggregate cost is the hauling cost. Typically, the economic haul distance is about 20 miles from the source. Truck hauling adds about 25 to 30 cents per yard per mile. In summary, ODOT is dependent on a large quantity of high-quality aggregate in the Willamette Valley. If the availability of aggregate is limited, the cost of highway projects will increase. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes. I think I can clear up my other question for later right now with the representative from ODOT.
All right.
Do you believe that aggregate mining can be reasonably accommodated in either our exception areas or our non-resource lands that are acknowledged either there or on resource land irrevocably committed to non-resource uses or in a UGB?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, I'm not sure I can answer that question. We're a large user of aggregate, and we get it from a number of sources, but to answer that detailed question for an aggregate, I'm not sure I can give you a good, complete answer on that.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Was this letter from somebody other than you? How was it?
No.
Okay. Well, in the bill, it says, or in the letter, it says if House Bill 3099 is adopted, I believe some of the language is may prevent us from opening new sites in the Willamette Valley. Because the only standards in the bill are if you cannot reasonably accommodate them in those three areas, then you get to keep doing everything you've been doing. It troubles me a little bit that you can't answer the question, because in the letter you said we wouldn't be able to open any new sites, and those are the only standards. The letter also refers to an exceptions process, and there is no such exceptions process. It would be more accurate to say there is a determination needed before you can keep doing everything that you've been doing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, our assumption in reading through the bill has been, as previous people have testified, the hurdle to open new sites will be considerable. And if that hurdle is considerable, it'll be more difficult to open new sites and less, again, less competition. If we have less sites to less bidders and less sites to compete for our projects.
Well, I have no more questions. I read you the hurdles, and because you can't tell me one way or the other, I don't know if they're considerable. I was hoping you could, but those are the hurdles.
All right. I think we're nearing the end. Gloria and Jerry Bennett and Nunzi Gould. Are the Bennetts here? Okay. Then we will bring up Brock Howell also.
Vice Chair Garrett, Representative Committee members. My name is Nunzi Gould. I live in Deschutes County on EFU land that I farm. I have a couple questions, and they may not be related specifically to this bill, but they relate to an issue that's going on presently in Deschutes County, which is the siting of commercial venues that promote wedding and events on farmlands. And without knowing more specifically within this bill definitions for passive outdoor recreation opportunities, or small-scale active outdoor recreation opportunities, without understanding the definitions of small-scale versus large-scale, I'm not sure if weddings would be allowed under this private park definition that you have under House Bill 3099. So I'm not sure what small-scale really relates to. Is it the number of events, number of visitors, valuations to the community, number of employees, frequency of hosting? Is it limited by acreage or buffer to adjacent properties? Is small scale commercial or not? Does an owner need to live on the parcel in question for it to comply? Again, an active recreational opportunity, is this a truck rally or a dirt bike competition? Is a commercial wedding event with amplified music an active recreational opportunity? Again, is there minimum criteria for acreage in a private park? Is there minimum criteria for buffering of a private park? And what started me thinking on this is there seems to be a criteria for 10 campsites or yurts within this bill. And I'm thinking, shouldn't there also be some similar benchmark for other events hosted in a private park? And what that would be, I don't have a suggestion. And if maybe I can be in touch with your committee members to understand what the definitions are that you have in mind for this, my questions may already be answered by your replies. So I thank you.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel, did you have a question?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, ma'am, thanks for coming again. You were here before prior to this. How big is your farm?
I live on 20 acres, and I farm 16 acres.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Howell?
Thank you, Vice Chair Garrett and members of the committee. My name is Brock Howell, and I am a transportation and land use advocate for Environment Oregon, where we represent our 30,000 members to help protect clean air, clean water, and open space. And I'm here to support this reasonable approach that is taken by this bill towards how we deal with exclusive farm use lands. I think that the key here is that we we need to minimize the impacts on agriculture to make sure that our industry can continue to stay vibrant for the next century. We don't know exactly what crops are going to be produced, but the critical element is to make sure that we continue to have the farmland to be able to farm those lands. And from our perspective, farming and having food here in Oregon is very important, as is to be able to provide the experience of open space as well. In terms of aggregate mining, our position is this is a reasonable approach to be able to set the standard of whether you can reasonably find another source within your county or your region. So we do not view it as prohibiting aggregate mining in any sort if absolutely necessary, but that this is a critical step to make sure we prioritize farming where we can. So with that, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you both. That's everybody who had signed up. The Bennetts arrived. I guess not. Anybody else who did not sign up who wants to testify in the 1 minute we have left? Take that as a no. Anything else for the good of the order, committee? Close the public hearing on House Bill 3099. With no further business, the committee's adjourned.
I thought the schools would be in here.